Hey, what's up? This is Johnny from The Drowns, and you're listening to the Mabel Syndrome Podcast.
It sucks, I still think Mabel Shay's the bomb.
Hey everyone, this is Kristen from Mabel Syndrome, and I'm without my co-host today. Brad, you don't know, but I usually have my co-host Jessica with me, and she had a family situation that she had to deal with, so I'm running solo today.
Oh no.
But my special guest is Brad Logan of so many projects. We're going to touch on all of them, but thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Kristen.
Yeah.
Happy to be here.
Awesome. You were just saying you're heading out on tour.
I am. Next week with I play bass in the Adolescents, and we're doing a tour with the Circle Jerks and Negative Approach, two of my all-time favorite bands. So I'm pretty excited. Three of my all-time favorite bands, actually, if you include the Adolescents.
So
I'm pretty excited about it, and it's the first touring I've done in a couple of years now. So
are you nervous?
Not now. I'm pretty, you know, I'm excited about it now. I was, you know, there was some anxiety. I don't think, you know, the anxiety was more, oh my God, you know, how am I going to leave to go anywhere? I have, you know, so much on my plate. I can't leave, you know, I can't leave town, you know? And so that was the anxiety really. Oh my God, traveling, you know, and just being some old man complaining too. But that passed after a couple of days. Now I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah. You were probably just out of the routine of it. Like before, it was just like going out on tour again, and then staying home for so long, it probably is just feels that much bigger.
It does. Right. It was reversed, you know, pre-pandemic and where I was gone all the time. But now, you know, I've been home for a couple of years, and I like touring and I love playing gigs, but you know, I also really love being home too. So, you know, that was kind of a thing I was introduced to, you know, as a result of, you know, everything that we all know about, right, for the past couple of years. So,
yeah. Speaking about being home, Kristen, your wife, is kind of helped set this up a little bit. And she's an amazing person. I've know her just barely. I can't wait to meet her in person. Since yesterday was Valentine's Day, I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit like about her and about how you guys met.
What can I say about her? I mean, she is, you know, I mean, the love of my life, but you know, we are, you know, couldn't be more opposite of, you know, personality wise and as people. And I think that's, you know, part of why it works is, you know, she's everything I am not. And to me, that's very valuable. Right. But she doesn't agree with, you know, everything I say and think and all of my likes and musically or, you know, whatever artistically. And I love that, you know, she's her own person.
Yeah.
And so that was very attractive to me. And the way we met was, you know, couldn't have been more random. You know, it's talked about in the Architects of Self-Destruction book a little bit. But you know, I was on, tour with another band. In between tours with my own bands, I would work as crew, you know, for various bands. And I was out on the road with this one band and we had, some shows cancel in the Midwest, and we ended up staying in Lawrence, Kansas for 3 days. Right. Which is where she was living and where I met her. You know, I went into this record store that was there in the middle of, you know, the main street, and I just saw her there behind the counter, it was like really one of those like pow moments of like, oh my God, who is this person? You know, she was wearing this, you know, long sort of, you know, down to the floor, you know, old, 50s, very brightly colored dress, and you know, just had this insane looking, you know, floral arrangement of hair on her head, you know, and I approached her, and I, you know, very awkwardly asked her if she had some, you know, record there, you know, as sort of an excuse to like, oh my God, I want to talk to this person. And she was like super like icy to me. And I was just like, oh my God.
Did that make you like her more?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I'm like, who is this person? And so, you know, through the remainder of the days that we were there, I kept going back into the record store to see if she was there, and she never was. And so the band that I was with played this venue that was next door to the record store on the last day. And I just left a note under the door of the record store. One of the stagehands I was working with, I go, hey, you know, do you know the girl that works at the record store next door that looks like this? She's like, oh yeah, that's my good friend, Kristen, and blah, 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 blah. So I got a name and I did something very uncharacteristic. You know, I just left a note under the door of like, you know, hey, Kristen, you don't know me. My name's Brad. I'd love to say hi to you sometime. And I left an email address, you know, and really I just, had zero expectations of maybe anything other than a conversation, and get to know this person. And I wasn't dating, I wasn't looking for anything, you know.
Well, and you didn't know if she was single either.
Right. And I didn't want anything but to get to know this, like, insane, beautiful, insane, icy person. Like, oh, there's something there, right? And so she wrote me back like 3 weeks later, like, you know, I got an email like, who is that? You know, she thought it was like some piss take that her friends were pulling on her.
In the book that it's uncharacteristic of her too, kind of just took a risk and responded.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so this was pre-internet, you know, I don't even remember what it was. Maybe
you're probably like, here's my AOL.
I did. I told her I'm in these bands, you know, and you can look, you can look me up on these records that are probably in your record store. That's because there there was no website or, you know, it was pre like Facebook or any of that. And I'm like, I promise you, I'm not a psycho. I'm in this band and, you know, there are people that know me she just still thought I was a psycho. And so, and then the rest, I guess, is history. I don't think either of us thought we would ever be together. And then neither of us ever thought we would last more than a year, you know, and so here we are, you know, 20 years down the road.
Yeah. It's crazy. That's sweet. Yeah. I like that. You mentioned the book and I have it here and I just wanted to hold it up for people that are looking. It's Architects of Self-Destruction, The Oral History of Leftover Crack. What was your idea why write a book?
Because there was just, I assume the same for any band, right? Any touring band, there was just so many insane, road stories and just the personalities of the people in the band and everybody that we interacted with. To me, the band was just so unique in a lot of ways and so many unbelievable things had happened up to that point. I'm like, no one would believe these tales and somebody's got to document this and someone should write a book. That's how it started.
Right, right.
You know, just driving around and ha ha ha, someone should write a book. And then when nobody wrote a book, I'm like, well, fuck, I'm going to write the book, and so it was really that simple. You know, I had no experience in being, a writer of books or anything like that. Interviewing people, anything like that. It was just I decided to do it and did it,
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And it's parts of different people's take on different things, right? So that it's interesting because it'll be your take on a situation and then Sturgeon's take on a situation and then Alex's take on a situation or whatever it is. So how did you get their input? Did you interview them? Orally, or did you write out some things to them?
I really always enjoyed that format for a book, especially, about a band or any sort of, you know, setting where a lot of people were involved. And I had read some books prior to that, you know, Please Kill Me and the Edie Sedgwick book and, you know, other ones, that had that format. And I thought it was just such a great way to present, a story where, you know, because what's true, right? Everybody has a different perspective. Everybody has a different experience, you know, that's unique to them.
And you aren't afraid to say that in the book too. Like someone will chime in and say, well, that's not how I remember it.
Yes. And that's one of the things that's really awesome about doing that is just, you know, contradictory, you know, statements and stories right after each other, you know, you know, because we all, or at least I like to think that the way I'm looking at this thing is the right way to look at it, but you know, is it the right way to look at it? Right. You know, in my opinion, but it's just my, you know, my opinion. So, I knew I wanted to do that kind of book instead of just like, you know, one person's tale of all this stuff, which is just really boring to me. Plus I knew that the cast of characters surrounding the band was just, you know, just some of the weirdest, greatest, you know, most awesome, insane people ever. I enlisted John to help me interview people. John Gentile was a journalist, and he had experience, you know, writing and being a journalist. I had no experience, you know, as a journalist or any writings other than, you know, journals or songwriting. I don't even remember how John and I met, but I knew him and I knew that he was a writer. And I'm like, hey, you want to help me write this book? And I asked a few people to help me write it and they were just not interested in, and he was, he was like, oh, sounds like fun. Yeah. But I knew that, it was going to be a big job just interviewing people. And then, so I did a combination of in person, you know, holding people hostage, or email some of it or on the phone, you know, on speakerphone with a digital recorder next to the phone. And then, transcribing it and editing it and all that stuff I love the whole process. I love the work. I love the interviewing. I love the shit work, the transcribing, the editing, and fitting the pieces together like a puzzle, you know,
right.
Constructing it. Like, I just love the work. It's not, to me, it doesn't work. It's a puzzle, you know? So, I really dug it and some people didn't want to be interviewed, didn't want to talk to me, didn't want to talk about the band. And I knew that from the onset, the band, you know, always had, you know, a very divided, very polarized, polarizing presence. You know, either people wanted, you know, the band dead, or they had grudges or vendettas, or were just sold their souls, you know, for the music. And which I thought was interesting in itself, you know, to be in that setting. I never, felt like I was the creator of that. I was just, you know, an observer, right. Even though I'd been in the band since the onset, I still felt like, you know, like an observer of it and just watching it. But wasn't there a time,
I feel like I read that you worked with the band and then you joined the band.
Yes. Well, yeah, right. That's how it started. I was working at Hellcat Records, right, which was Tim from Rancid's label. And I worked on the Choking Victim record, with Tim and with Hellcat. And that's how I got to know, Sturgeon and, all of those guys, around that band. And then when Sturgeon was putting a new band together, he just asked me if I wanted to play guitar. And I was already in was doing F minus and in other bands. And I was like, sure, you know, it was that easy. It wasn't any big deal. I didn't ever think it would go anywhere, you know?
Okay.
Never thought
but you knew Sturgeon, you knew that he was polarizing, you knew that he was complex, but you didn't, you were just like, yeah, this sounds great. Like, oh, there wasn't a second thought about that really.
Well, not at the time. I mean, at the time there wasn't, at the time, he was just this kid from New York City. You know, he was like 20 years old, and there was no reputation that preceded him. There was no history of this or that. He was just a kid, you know, a kid from the Lower East Side living in a C-squad. And I thought he was hilarious. You know, I thought he was a funny kid. I thought he had some, he was a great songwriter. He had some twisted ideas, you know. We liked a lot of the same music, and it was that simple, you know. I didn't think anybody, I didn't even put any thought into whether anybody would care about the band or the music or any of that kind of stuff. There was no thought at all.
Yeah.
Because people would ask me to play in their bands, you know, that would happen to me all the time. And I played in, you know, many bands for, you know, for one show or recording or this or that, you know, so that wasn't unusual. And it's like, oh yeah, I like this kid. Sure. You know, hell yeah, I'd love to. And he had sent me a cassette of some new songs that he was working on. He was living in like rural Montana, I think. And sent me a cassette of these tunes and they were great. You know, I was a fan of Choking Victim, that record. And, you know, and it was really different than what was, you know, anything that was happening at Epitaph, you know, or Hellcat at the time. You know, it was a lot of things, right? A lot of weird things that shouldn't be in the same room together, you know, metal and ska and, you know, what the fuck is going on? But it worked, right?
So. Yeah, yeah. But as, you know, as you guys are forming the band and the early stages of the band and everybody's coming and going, but you always stayed there and you seem to, from what I gather in the book, had a very level head about the whole thing where people are coming and going and doing all this stuff and you're sticking by. You know, I think you left a show once or something and walked off and you know, kind of maybe quit at that moment, but then probably got back in the van and went to the next town or whatever it was. But you always pushed through it. Is that kind of who you are?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know who I am, but I know that you know, it's a complex situation. I mean, I think that, you know, I was used to being in chaotic situations and it didn't start that way, right? It did not start that way. But growing up, you know, the way I grew up and the people I grew up with, you know, and then the years that I spent myself, on the streets and whatnot. I mean, you know, there wasn't a whole lot that just surprised or shocked me about in any sort of chaotic situations. You know, I was kind of detached from it. And so to me, there's, you know, there's good chaos and there's bad chaos. You know, the good chaos is you know, in the name of fun, right? Or in the name of
art, suppose.
Right? Mm-hmm. You know, where people aren't getting hurt, you know, and then there's bad chaos, which is, you know, the opposite of that, where, you know, people are getting, you know, damaged from it and destroyed. And so when, you know, that started to flip, in my opinion, from good chaos to bad chaos. And we talked about this the other day, I think, you know, part of, you know, my damage as a person is thinking that, you know, when things started to, you know, go bad and stay bad, you know, I thought that, you know, I could fix things, you know, and, I have some experience, you know, pulling myself out of, you know, this situation or that situation. And so I can help this, you know, I can help turn it around and I could fix things and, you know, and it's going to end up being okay. And that was rather, you know, big headed and self-righteous of me to think, you know, that I could, you know, that I could change anything really except for myself or my own behavior, you know, as far as, you know, I don't have any control over people, you know, I don't have any control over situations. Does that answer that question?
Yeah. Yeah. Was the death of Brandon a big, like kind of turning point in terms of, you know, it seemed like things were kind of under control. And then all of a sudden that was a big shock to the system.
No, I mean, you know, that wasn't, I mean, it sucked, you know, it was horrible. And you know, we found him, you know, and Ezra, you know, I was standing right there next to Ezra when he was giving him mouth to mouth, you know, and we were there for every minute of it. It wasn't this thing we just heard about, you know, and it fucking sucked. At the same time, by that point, there were many, many people in my life that had died from drug overdoses or in drug or alcohol related car wrecks or, you know, by their own hand through, you know, suicide or whatever. And so that wasn't anything, that was out of the ordinary, mm-hmm. you know, as far as that went. And I would rather have that not happened. You know, I mean, I don't advocate, you know, I don't take drugs, I don't drink, right? But like, I don't tell people what to do with their life. You know, it's like, it's none of my business what somebody wants to do with their life as far as any of that goes, or as far as anything else goes. Right. Yeah. And you know, that comes with the territory, you know, if you're going to fuck around with that, that is a thing that can happen. And I've seen that happen more often than not.
Mm-hmm.
So we were all pretty torn up about it. And actually I didn't know if the band was going to continue. None of us did really, you know, at that point, but it ended up continuing and we pushed ahead and
at one point, so you just mentioned that you don't engage in drugs and alcohol and things. And so, and that was at some point while you were a member of Leftover Crack that you got sober?
No, that was before.
Oh, it was before. Okay. Yeah. So you were sober the entire time during that band.
Yeah. When I stopped doing, you know, taking drugs and, you know, drinking, I was a nobody, a nobody from nowhere doing nothing.
Okay. You
know? And I'm still a nobody from nowhere doing nothing, but you know, it was very, it wasn't working out well for me. You know, I spent a lot of years, having it, you know, on the bad side of it, you know, and having it not work out.
Seeing friends kind of go down that similar path, I would think you empathize with that.
I do empathize with it. Yes. But I also know there's nothing you can do. There was nothing anybody could do for me until I wanted to do something for myself. There was absolutely nothing anybody could do. Mm-hmm. You know, all of the help that people were offering or begging me to, you know, to get help, my parents, my, you know, my mother, my friends, you know, my sisters, and none of it mattered until I was completely stripped of everything, you know, and completely crushed under it, and totally alone, that, you know, that I decided there was just a tiny voice in the back of my head to maybe try things a different way, you know?
Yeah.
And for myself, there was nobody that cared anymore. You know, well, if I could get, you know, if I can just quit doing this, then I can do this. It was like, I didn't want anything but to be out of that hell, you know? Yeah. I didn't care what happened to me. I just wanted to be out of that hell, you know?
Yeah.
If I could just have a little job and a place to live or something, that would be like beyond my wildest dreams, you know?
Yeah. And so do you have that conversation with people that you're worried about, or do you just not even bother anymore?
Have you ever tried that?
I have. It doesn't do much.
Yeah. How'd that work? Right.
Yeah. Not so great.
No. Against my better judgment, I've tried to have that conversation with people.
Yeah.
Against knowing what I know about myself, you know, and it just falls, you know, it's like, great, that's great.
Well,
you
maybe
know,
and maybe there's a selfish element to it, but I always feel like at least I tried, like, you know, at least if something happens, at least I tried. Like, it's probably not going to do anything. Obviously they need to, you can lead a horse to water, whatever there, you know, but I do feel like sometimes at least I tried.
I've told myself that too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think that, you know, I always knew you know, when I was at my worst, that there were alternatives to it. People didn't even have to tell me. I knew, you know. In the end, I mean, really, I just try and, continue to do what I'm doing and be there if somebody needs help. You know, I don't need to sell it, right? Because it just doesn't fucking work. It doesn't work on people like me. But I try and to continue to not go down those roads, you know, with drugs and alcohol, let's say, and I'm not very vocal about it, but people have asked me, you know, like, hey, I noticed there's this raging fucking chaos going on, and what's up with you? You know, and maybe at that point, you know, we could talk about it, right? But I could, you know, if I can ever be of help, I'm, you know, that's my like job, is to be of help, right? To help people out who are in trouble, especially along those lines. But I know that, you know, that it's apparent, you know, you can't make somebody do something that I don't want to fucking do. You can't. All the
right.
And this is the story of, you know, that question you were asking me earlier. And I tried, I wasn't listening to my own advice. And I'm going to fix this. I'm going to help. I'm going to make it better. And it almost killed me, really. At the end of the day, it almost killed me, literally. Mm-hmm. It almost killed me, you know.
Trying to keep that band together. Is that what you're saying?
Trying to control situations that were uncontrollable, you know, and help people that didn't want to be helped. And it's not just confined to the band. I mean, I see that in my daily life all the time. You know, the band was just, you know, another example of it, but it certainly wasn't unusual from any other situations that I see going on at any given time.
Yeah.
You know, like we, you know, politics, you know, anything like that. It's like, you know, what can I do? You know? And so in the end, and I mean, I knew what I wanted to do for a decade, you know, but it took me about 10 years to just walk away, man. I just had to walk away.
Yeah.
You know, that was the only thing I could do.
Let's talk about that. So you made a public post that you left the band Leftover Crack, which I imagine was, you said took 10 years basically to get yourself to do. How did that feel instantly, like a weight was lifted, I would imagine?
No.
Or did you feel sad? How did you feel?
Yeah, it was... Didn't feel like a weight was lifted, you know.
No.
It was like leaving a you know, a long-term relationship, you know. It was very sad, you know, and on a lot of levels. You know, the ending for me was filled with confusion, and sadness and self-pity, and it wasn't pretty, you know, but it, for me, it was the, only choice, you know, it was the only choice. And so, it took a long time. It took a long time for me to see that was the, you know, that was the only choice.
Who helped you make that choice? Like talking with your wife, friends, family, who, like, did anyone help you with that?
I talked to a lot of people. Yes. Yeah. You know, but in the end it was like, the same with like, you know, the toxic substances that I'd lived on for years. In the end, the you know, the choice had to be mine alone, you know, and that's what it was, you know, came to me in the middle of the fucking night or whatever. Right. I just got up and I did it, you know, one day. And that statement that I posted wasn't any sort of statement to be like, you know, I wasn't trying to say anything or look at me or any of that, any fucking thing like that. You know, it was, I didn't want to answer any fucking questions about it. You know, here's this, and this is this, and comments turned off. And if you have any questions, refer to that.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
It's all in there, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Well, I thought I wanted to share for my listeners too, for our fans, that I did interview Sturgeon once. It was a great experience. I went to a Leftover Crack show somewhere in OC, and I think it was the Glass House. Mm. Does that sound right?
Yeah, there's a Glass House here.
A few years ago, two or three years ago.
Lots of Glass Houses here.
Yeah. And I went on the bus and interviewed Sturgeon, and we had an amazing conversation for about an hour, hour and a half. And
we had a bus? Alex, couldn't have been our
Yeah,
bus.
We went up on the bus.
We never had a bus. We didn't... He went on someone else's bus.
Oh, no, no. It was definitely your guys' bus.
Really?
Yeah.
Yep. That's weird.
Yeah, because he went back to his bunk and he got his puppets, which I'm sure you know about. And he was eating garlic out of the fridge, like just raw garlic. And yeah, we had a great conversation.
Sounds pleasant.
And I was, you know, we talked about lots of things, and he was charming and kind and nice. And Alec came on for a little bit too, and we talked with him and about their friendship from growing up and lots of things. And I was really excited to release the episode. And I was in the middle of editing the episode, and some things came out online that I didn't feel comfortable with that, sure. That he had done. And I had to make the decision to just squash the whole thing. So I had, you know, 2 hours with Sturgeon that I spent, and then hours of editing that I had done, and squashed the whole thing because I felt like, for me, not knowing him very well and not knowing the situation very well, but when something comes out about a person that hits you wrong, that you're like, well, this is where my line is, right? So I felt like that was where my line was, and I didn't feel comfortable putting his interview up on our website, up on our podcast. And so that was the event for me. Was there something for you that made you finally pull the plug?
You mean any one incident that made me pull the plug? No. I mean, it was a combination of things, you know, that were all consistent with how things were going for a long time.
Yeah. Okay. You know?
I think that the one thing that, if there was any one sort of incident, the one realization I came to was, I was either going to put a rope around my neck or, go to a place mentally I wasn't going to be able to come back from, you know? So that was the deciding factor as far as any severity of incidents, you know, I mean, it it was constant chaos for a long time. Right. And, you know, I can only live in that for, I guess, my threshold of pain. I have a high tolerance for it, but my threshold of it was, you know, I guess it was 10 years from when I started saying, man, you know, I'm out of here, to when I actually did. You know, a band is also more than, you know, one person too. And there were, you know, to me, a band is a, you know, I don't care if there's like, you know, one person's writing all the songs or, you know, somebody's the leader, this and that. It's like, you know, it's a combination of people that make up a band. So that situation, as much as it was detrimental in a lot of ways, there was also a lot of beauty in it too. And I was working with some very unique and very talented and wonderful people, and was crossing paths with some people that were really fucking wonderful people. So there was that, you know, going on too within me, right? It's like, you know, this isn't all, you know, it wasn't all just black or white. Like, it's all just fucking misery. It wasn't like that, you know? And the other people that I was playing with in the band, you know, some great, you know, I know there were a lot of people in and out of the band, but some very, very far more talented than me, you know, I'm just a fucking hack, but there were, you know, very talented people in and out of that band, you know, songwriters and musicians and artists, you know, and other bands that we toured with, and the labels that we worked with. I don't know. Does that answer your question? I kind of went off on a tangent.
Yeah, I know. It's a really tough thing to talk about. And I think,
you know, the fucking bad shit just started to outweigh the good shit. and, you know, and it just got too shitty for too long, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, if it's not going to fucking change, I'm out. Catch you fucking later. I have my own problems, my own personal problems to deal with. And I'm going to go fucking work on those, you know? Even if I never play in another band ever again, I'm going to go work on my stuff. Because that's, you know.
Yeah. Do you think that there's enough help for bands out there in terms of mental health? And I've been told by several people that, like, you know, on these big cruises that that bands are doing these days or whatever, there'll be AA meetings on the cruise for musicians and stuff. And so there's some of those. There's Music Cares. There's some other organizations out there that address all sorts of things that go on with musicians. But it doesn't seem like there's enough.
I mean, definitely, continue to make, you know, when I was a kid going to punk shows and growing up, there wasn't any, you know, there wasn't anything like that. People didn't talk about having like mental health issues or, you know, depression or feeling suicidal or, you know, I guess they did, but it wasn't like, I know my own feelings about it was like, I didn't want to like talk about those things and seem and come off being weird in front of people, you know, like, you know, I'm depressed. I feel like fucking killing myself, you know? So there was, in the community resources for those things were, they were inaccessible. We didn't know about them. You know, there, it just seemed like it was, way out of reach, you know, like, oh, $150 an hour to go to a psychologist, you know, and it's like, what the fuck? So I think, you know, having, and Music Cares is great, man. I think Music Cares has helped a lot of people I know, you know, that were in serious trouble, as well as, you know, me. And I think just keeping that, those things visible the resources for those types of things, keeping the visibility as high as we can, you know, at the shows, you know, the venues, the any way that can be done to point people into in those directions is a step step in the right direction, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, again, you can't. You can't force somebody to get help, right? But at least you know, here's a place you can go. You know, here's a place you can go discreetly. You don't even have to tell anybody you're doing it.
Right, for free sometimes.
For free,
yeah.
Yes, mm-hmm. Please, for free. You know, people who are volunteering to help people who have been there, you know, volunteering to help other people that have been there. I think that is something that, you know, and I'm seeing a lot more of it done these days, and it's pretty fucking cool, you know, the punk community. Yeah. and you know, the music industry, you know, at large, it's much more talked about and out there. You know, at least more so than when I was a kid, there was nothing.
right
you know.
Yeah.
Punk I think music and the gigs were the escape. That was the therapy, you know. That was the therapy and the escape from the parents, from the dysfunctional family, from the from the world outside that didn't understand, you know, that didn't understand that you didn't even understand yourself, you know. Mm-hmm. And here was a place to go where you didn't have to fucking explain yourself, you know, and you could just go there and just be whatever fucking weirdo you were, you know.
Right. And be accepted.
And be accepted. Yeah. But that didn't make the problems inside go away, right? You know, here was a place to go, but it didn't just poof, like all of a sudden you love yourself now, you know, it just doesn't work that way.
Right. I see mental health trending positively in the punk rock community, but I also see support of women and victims trending well in the punk rock community. And I think that one of the reasons that people are afraid to support Sturgeon right now is because there are some accusations out there against him. And I'm just wondering, is that something that's talked about in the music community among artists? Like, you know, it kind of hit fans first almost, like, we're going to not support these artists that have accusations against them. Do you think it's hit the actual artists yet that say we're not going to support our friends that have accusations against them? We're going to, you know, that kind of thing. Has that been talked about in the punk rock community from what you know?
I don't know. I have to agree with you that definitely I'm seeing a lot more support. But this is from the viewpoint of a fucking old white male, you know? So, you know, what do I know? I mean, it seems to me like, that the awareness is out there and it's something that's talked about, you know, on a public level. You would know better than I would, you know. I mean, you know, is it? I mean, is it you know, how do you feel about it? I think is a better question. You know, what, you know, it doesn't, you know, women in music have always been in my life. That's just, you know, the way it's always been for me since my very first shows and bands and you know, bands that I liked. And, you know, I grew up with sisters and you know, very strong women in my family. And so that's just always been a part of my life. So, you know, I don't know if I'm, you know, qualified to even like, you know, comment on that. Like, what the fuck do I know? You know?
Yeah.
And so thinking about those things has always been a part of my life and talking about those things and addressing those things has always been a part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
But you would know better than I would if that's like, you know, what's being talked about, if that actually translates to a reality, you know,
right.
You know, I mean, do you feel more comfortable, you know, in the community and at shows, you know, how do you feel?
Well, I'm one of the only women that I personally know of my female friends that like punk rock. I'm probably the only one that has not been drugged at a show. I have not been groped at a show. So I've had positive experiences, but just recently I was at a show and I was trying to message my friend there all night and I didn't know where she went. And then she messaged me the next day from the hospital because she had been drugged. And I feel like it's something that we don't talk about enough, but I do feel like it's trending in the right direction. And I hope that some more organizations like Music Cares and things like that kind of step up and keep having conversations around these issues.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't think that it was confined to just the punk community. It was just like, you know, it's our society at large, man. It was like the same shit that was going on in high school and just, you know, it's like, and then to see that sort of stuff, you know, I don't know, you know.
Yeah. It's hard to see it in our community though. Cause sometimes, I don't know about you, but I feel like in punk rock, like they're my people, they're my brothers, they're my sisters, and they're, you know, and I want to feel safe going to shows, and I want to feel like everyone has my back. If someone groped me, I want to run up to the band and be like, get this fucker out of here, you know, whatever.
Mm. I think,
and I just,
I'm sorry to cut you off. Please continue.
No, I'm just glad that it's trending in that direction. But I just was wondering if artists feel it as well, because we feel it, I think, as fans, that it's being talked about more. Believe women, abusers are being called out, accusations are being made about people, and I just was wondering if it's kind of infiltrating artists' world as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, you know, I mean, I guess it depends on you know, the artists, right, and the people, but. Certainly the pack I run with, you know, it's very, open and talked about and, you know, mm-hmm. it's very real situations, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
I can only answer for a small microcosm, you know, of the people out there, but, yeah, I think it is, you know. I agree.
Good.
Yeah.
So to change the subject from something that's super tough, I guess this could be tough too, but you took a role in The Adolescents recently. I never had the opportunity to meet Steve Soto. I've heard amazing things. I I was at Punk Rock Bowling a couple years ago when the adolescents played, and people were crying, and so I just was wondering if you'd tell me about him a little bit. Like, what was it about him that was so captivating to people?
Steve was like, he was just a genuinely like nice guy, man. I mean, he was just a good soul, man, whatever that means. He was a nice guy, and he had been, especially a guy who had been, in the trenches as long as he had been, adolescents, at that point were coming up on 40 year anniversary and in the fucking trenches, man. And he was still just a decent, nice human being. And I think that's what, and also being incredibly, talented, gifted, musician, songwriter, arranger, but that's like, I think the thing that was, attractive, and attracted people to him and, was that he was still, just very approachable, fucking nice guy, down to earth. And, he was, well beyond legendary status and was just like super approachable, down to earth, nice guy, with a great sense of humor.
Yeah.
And,
that's awesome.
So those were all the things that I loved about him, I was on the last tour that he did with the Adolescents. I just happened to be, riding along with him, driving the van and selling merch. And, he called me out of the blue and was like, "Hey, we're going to do this East Coast run and, you want to come along and sling merch?" And I was like, "Hell yeah, that sounds like fun." So I jumped in the van him and I were rooming together and, they'd play the show and, we'd go back to the hotel and, be up, laughing like, we were 15, shooting the shit, till 4 in the morning every night and laughing our asses off. And we played Boston, right. New York City and a few other places. And then I took them to the airport, dropped them off. I stayed in New York and a few days later I was thumbing through Facebook and somebody had posted that he passed away. And I was like, what, it was like, when you see something like, that your brain cannot just compute,
you're like, but I just saw him. I was just with him.
Right. I can equate it to watching the World Trade Center fall down. It's like, this is not really happening. This cannot be happening. And it was the same sort of thing. It's like, wait, what? No, this is a hoax. I was just with him 2 fucking days ago. He's fine.
Yeah.
And I made some calls and sure enough, he passed away in his sleep and that the band had, a bunch of commitments still like show wise and tour wise. And they asked a few people, they wanted to fulfill the commitments because that's the kind of band they were, it's the kind of guy Steve was, they didn't cancel things. Right. He was a fucking warrior. So they asked me, I was one of the people they asked, and I wasn't the only person they asked, but I was the guy with the most, available time. Right. And so I said yes. And I had about, 2 weeks to, before that there was a tour of Europe that they needed to do. And they sent me about 40 or 50 songs to learn in like 2 weeks. Here you go, buddy. It's like, what? There was nobody to show me these songs because, to show me his parts, right? Because only he knew his parts and he's a great bassist and musicians far better than me. So I was like struggling, to like listen to these things and learn them and try and get them right. And I was super intimidated, by the whole thing, nervous as hell. And I remember the first show was in Germany and right before we played, Tony leaned over to me and he just went, 40 years, man, legacy, just fucking with me, right? You know?
Yeah.
Because I was like, oh, fuck, you know?
Yeah, no big deal.
Yeah, he knew I was like super nervous about it. You know, it's like stepping into, you know, to stand in. And that's what I consider myself, is I'm standing in for my friend, you know? It's his band. It's Steve's band and Tony's band. And you know, I'm standing in for him, right? That's how
it feels still?
That's how it feels, yeah.
Yeah.
You know? He can't make these shows and I'm standing in for him and, you know, I'm trying to do my best to honor him as a punker. You know, the man was a punk rocker and give it my best to go out there and be a fucking punker, man, you know? And so that's what I try and do. I make tons of mistakes. I'm not the best musician, you know, but I love the band, you know, and I love him. So.
That's awesome. And finally, I wanted to ask about the punk rock garage sale, the ear damage. That sounds so fun. How did that come about?
For those who don't know, I've started a, Kristen and I have started a record swap / underground art market in San Pedro called Ear Damage. And it's because we're both weirdo. I'm a weirdo collector and music fan.
What do you collect?
I collect comic books. I collect records. I collect posters. I collect weird, trinkets and memorabilia. Gear, I don't really collect music gear, because that's just, I guess it's all kind of an expensive hobby, but, I like to trash dig, you know what I mean? So it was a way to, I had a friend who had an empty warehouse and it's like, oh man, you know, it'd be great, you know, to use it. You know, I asked him if I could use it for this thing, you know, twice a month we're going to do it. And it's a way to mingle with other, you know, collector weirdos and bizarro people and that's what it's going to be, you know, people who
do
make,
people sign up to join in, like,
yes, there's a website. Okay. If you live in California, it's, www.eardamage.net. And you can sign up to sell your shit and records, memorabilia, art, if you paint, if you make, clothing, if you, bizarre, a friend of mine who makes her own, leatherware is going to be there and
nice.
As well as some painters and just some very, some really, really cool stuff,
Yeah.
So, been working on that. The first one's March 19th, San Pedro, downtown San Pedro. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. That's awesome. It sounds fun.
You collect?
No, I'm not a collector.
No?
No. My partner Jessica is, though. She collects lots of things. No, I'm like, get it out. I don't want it. I see it once and then I'm like, it's someone else's.
And you know what? I have to do that. I have to do that annually, take stock yeah. and just go, all right, some shit's got to go here, right?
Right,
and,
right.
And, we're not like, I'm not like hoarder status, to where there's just, I can't walk through my room or,
Right.
I
guess I collect art. I have some art from Jesse Michaels and I have some art from some other, so punk rock artists is kind of what I'm starting to get into a little bit.
Mm.
But art doesn't feel like collecting to me, although I guess it is. I don't know why. It just feels different, but.
Right. Now. I guess what is collecting, what is the right. definition of collecting? I guess that's like seeking out something that would go in a series, maybe,
Sure.
Like
a collection.
Yes. I have, right. A collection. I don't look at art that way either. We have stuff all over our walls and we'll see shit that we like. And it's like, there's no theme to it. There's no, series, or it's more like, oh, this is like a bizarro woodcut, from 1700s. Sweet. Or a local friend of ours who painted this like, bizarro, this is going up in the house.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's no rhyme or reason to it other than if it's appealing to us, on some inner level. You didn't ask about my new band either.
I know. I meant to. Yes. Tell me about it.
Shameless plug.
It's on my list.
Shameless plug alert. I got a new band with a friend of mine who is in England called Instant Ruin. And it's myself and my friend Gabba, who plays guitar for a band called Chaos UK, you may or may not know. And we've been, you know, working together for a lot of years. He was on an F minus album, you know, years ago on the last F minus album, and used to ride along on tours with us. And, you know, one of the first people we met when F minus started going over to, you know, England in the late '90s. But we, you know, we've been sending tracks back and forth, you know, throughout the whole pandemic. And it was like,
oh, nice.
Well, you know, fuck it. We're going to just start a band, you know,
yeah.
And a bi-country band, I guess.
Just the two of you guys?
It's just the two of us, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm going to go over to England in April and we're going to do a few dates out there. And it's going to be him and I. And my friend Dale is going to play guitar too. Another guy that we've known okay. out there for, you know, forever. And it's yeah. going to be real bare bones, you know, just the three of us, you know, fucking laptop, guitar, and a guy with a microphone.
Yeah.
And we have some tracks up on Bandcamp and I have a single, you know, at the plant for, you know, 7-inch being pressed of those songs. And then a kid in Italy, this couple in Italy is going to, do a 7-inch, another 7-inch with us. Both of those should be, available, you know, who knows when, right. You know, the wait at the pressing yeah. plants is pretty long these days. So hopefully
that's what I hear.
Yeah. Hopefully by the yeah. end of, you know, by fall. Right.
Right. Right.
And so, yeah, so that's going on. And
nice. What else? Any other big exciting things?
You know, I've been wanting to collab. There's a bunch of people I've been wanting to collaborate with musically. You know, people here locally, and we've talked about it. But I guess the difficulty is finding the time, right, to do it.
Yeah.
You know, so that's been the real struggle. I've been anything but bored during, you know, any part of this pandemic or any part of the lockdown. You know,
nice.
it's been a, you know, I don't get bored.
We let our guests pick a song for the end of the podcast. So can you think of a song that you're really digging these days that we should play?
Oh my God.
Could be anything.
I wish you'd have asked me that earlier.
Look at your phone and see what you're playing.
There are some new bands I really like. I got this, a couple 7-inches recently. One was by this band, called, I posted it on my Instagram called, Child's Pose, who are, just so great.
Well, let's give them a plug.
Shall we give them a plug?
Totally.
Here, hold on. I'll grab the 7-inch. I don't know anything about them really. Here's what the 7-inch looks like. Okay. It's called Eyes to the Right by Child's Pose. All I know is they're from England and, so, you know, it's like made up of members from some other bands. And one of the other bands I knew of that band, they were called
yeah.
Wolf. Wolf, like W-O-O-L-F. And
okay.
And this totally reminds me of like, you know, late 70s, like angular, jagged guitar, you know, like the Slits or something. And just, you know. Gang of Four, like all of that shit that I love, you know, of post-punk type stuff. And you know, it's four songs, but they're all just so fucking amazing. So,
yeah.
You can play anything off of this, you know, cool. You know, maybe Lil Snitch is good. That's a good one.
Okay. Okay. We'll do that.
All right.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Like the secret.